Hi, we are Drew Taylor and Charles Hood from Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, and you're listening to The Letterbox Show, whether you like it or not. You don't change the channel or anything. Yeah.
And we're excited to talk about four movies we feel are connected to the new Mission Impossible movie. That is The Hunt for Red October, Super Cop, that's Police Story 3, The Wrong Trousers, and The Lone Ranger.
And maybe, just maybe, we'll talk about Dead Reckoning Part 1 as well.
Hey, it's your old pal Slim, and welcome to The Letterbox Show, our podcast about movies and the people who love watching them. It's a special episode. It's already got one of my favorite things checked off the list. It's Tom Cruise related. Second thing, senior producer Brian Formo is making his four faves hosting debut.
It's a pleasure to be here because, as has been pointed out, together, Slim, you and I, we create a beard. So it's a yin and yang here. But
yes.
My first time as a Four Favorites host, but I have been a guest twice. They even brought me back. So
yeah.
You mentioned that this episode is Tom related, and the four faves we'll discuss are loose related to the new Mission Impossible. What better guests than the hosts of the official Mission Impossible podcast, Light the Fuse? Drew Taylor and Charles Hood, welcome to the Letterbox Show.
Hello.
Feeling hashtag blessed to be here, and yeah. Charles, how you feeling, buddy?
I feel great. Yeah. Are you okay?
I am okay.
Well,
it's been a long week, but hey, we're here.
There are a lot of very vocal people who are not okay, and those are the Letterbox audience that desperately wanted Tom Cruise's four favorites on the red carpet that we sent Slim to. He skirted the question a little bit and talked about his love of movies instead. So the most impossible mission, apparently, for us is getting Tom Cruise's four favorite films. But Drew and Charles, by being here, you're actually completing that mission. How impossible was it to come up with only four films that relate to Dead Reckoning Part 1?
We only got two each.
Yeah. we got shortchanged. I was like, oh, they're going to ask me about my top four films, because I was looking at it with Charles and I was like, yeah, those are good movies. But no.
No.
Just talking about Mission Impossible again, every day, all day, just Mission Impossible.
But the curse.
Yeah, it's a gift and a curse, but we thought we would choose two films each that we felt had a significant connection to the new film, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, which you can go see in premium formats right now, exclusively in theaters. So we're excited to talk about these.
Yeah, four of our favorites that feel kind of connected a bit to Dead Reckoning Part 1.
I mean, they're good. They're good picks. You can see it. Brian and I watched these or rewatched these this week, and it definitely jumps out at both of us as we're watching. So the podcast Light the Fuse is now, as we mentioned, the official podcast of Mission Impossible. And I remember, I think it was episode 200, big deal, Tom on the pod.
Mm-hmm.
Tom calling in from Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Of all places, I wish I could tell a story about how I called someone from Wimbledon.
He only does the most fabulous things.
That was the moment.
Yeah, it's not like he was coming back from Ralph's. He was coming back from Wimbledon. You know what I mean? He doesn't do anything kind of that the normal folk do. You know, it's always the most fabulous things that he's doing, the most fabulous movies that he's making. So it was actually pretty perfect. But yeah, we were Zoom bombed by Tom on the 200th episode. And that began a beautiful friendship with the man, the myth, the legend. And
How was the Rome premiere? I saw the photos posted. You both were out there. What was that experience like?
Had a lot of carbs, ate a lot of pasta, and we had a great time. We were on the red carpet. As you know, Tom likes to give everybody their moment. So it is the longest red carpet you will ever attend in your life. So we were there for a long time.
Last.
Got sucked.
We were at the very end of the red carpet. Yes. So we watched for 5 hours.
Well, at the beginning, we thought we might be the first, because we got like Simon and a couple of people. And then it was like, oh, no. They want to keep us as far away from everyone as possible, which is the right inclination. I'm not saying that is wrong. But no, we had a great time. We got to see the movie twice, caught up with Tom and McHugh and everybody. And it was a lovely time. And then we were just in New York with the cast and McHugh again, which was great, right before the New York premiere. So we've been all over this great globe with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Yeah, we did that cast chat in New York. Was really special. That's coming out on YouTube soon. And then we have a good 40 minutes or so from that conversation going to be coming out on our show as well, which is just, yeah, it was remarkable. It was amazing.
Letterboxd was there at that red carpet in New York.
Didn't you try to ask him about his four films?
And it's become an internet thing. It's become a moment for Letterboxd where Tom has not given his four faves.
Did he just refuse, or did he say every film is my favorite?
Well,
film?
We had a meeting beforehand. I believe Brian was in there too. And we're like, is Tom going to even answer us if we ask our normal four faves questions? So we tried to like big brain Tom. We're like, what if we ask him a different question? And I honestly thought this was the way in. We talked about like, what if, you know, Mission Impossible is a theatrical experience. You know, you see it on the big screen. You know, Tom, you love seeing movies on the big screen.
He loves movies.
When you look back on your life, what are some moments seeing movies on the big screen, you know, as a kid growing up? What are some of those movies that jump out at you? Nope.
It's too easy.
Tap danced on me.
Yep.
He saw right through you.
He wants you to work for it. And it's so interesting because like there are movies that they reference and we think we are going to be talking about some of them. And in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, he could have just leaned on those. We have a great conversation with him about the outlaw Josie Wales and how that influenced this great moment in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. So it's like he could have just trotted out one of those, but he didn't. He didn't want to. That's the easy way.
He didn't
out,
want to give okay? you anything.
Yeah.
He wanted nothing.
There have been videos that I've seen with him and McHugh, you know, specifically talking movies and other people. And I almost find it a little bit endearing too, that he won't really go deep on a movie or like talk about movies in a certain way unless he really knows you. And I kind of like respect that a little bit. Yeah, like, you know, keep those conversations a little bit closer to the vest.
Yeah. One of our dreams is, you know, you hear these stories about him inviting people over to his house and they just watch movies all night. And that's like the next echelon. Yeah.
That's the whole reason we did this. We started this podcast 5 years ago with the hopes that one day
we want to watch a Buster Keaton movie. Yeah, exactly.
That's it. That's the whole purpose. Yep. We did it. We sat down. We're like, how do we watch movies with Tom Cruise? Let's start making a podcast about Mission Impossible. Do one episode a week. We'll interview everyone who ever worked on a Mission Impossible movie. Then we'll become the official podcast. And one day he will ask us. So we're still working toward that goal.
God.
Yeah.
What a moment. Yeah.
It'll happen.
We got him to talk about the first time we talked with him when he Zoom bombed our 200th episode, we like sort of prompted and got some good stuff. We got him to talk about movies he never talks about. He talked about Legend and then we also got him to talk about movies that he loves, like Ordinary People. It was great. You know, cause there's that joke. Some people are like, has Tom Cruise ever seen a movie? Cause he kind of doesn't talk about, he like sidesteps. And it's like, he's seen everything. Like he has an amazing knowledge of movies.
Well, now, you've given us two, which is the same amount that that you each get for this execution.
Yes, so we got exactly. this. We're trying to get our picks in there.
We got Ordinary People and Outlaw Josie Wales.
Yes.
Fill in the rest.
But we have The Hunt for Red October is first on the list. This is Charles' pick, I do believe, from 1990, John McTiernan.
I'm co-signing this pick, though. I'm co-signing this pick. Yeah.
It's a great pick. Great pick. Synopsis, as written on Letterboxd, a new technologically superior Soviet sub, the Red October, is heading for the U.S. coast under the command of Captain Marco Rabiesh. The American government thinks he is planning to attack, but a lone CIA analyst has a different idea. He thinks he's planning to defect. But he only has a few hours to find him and prove it, because the entire Russian Naval Air Commands are trying to find him as well. Spoilers, this was a first-time watch for me.
What?
Oh,
finally, Jesus. After all these years.
Wow.
Should I just leave? But I feel like I've like absorbed this on like...
Yeah, see you later.
I feel like I've absorbed this over the years on like TBS, you know, or like TNT growing up. I probably have sat on a couch and
just
seen
like
it.
Pan and scan, cutting the commercials.
Exactly, like the worst possible experience that Tom would probably throw up at if he had seen it.
You watched Hunt for October for 5 minutes when you were 12 on TBS, butchered.
So Charles, do you have a history with this movie? And I know we chose these as being related to the Mission Impossible, but did you have a history with this kind of like growing up as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard for me to pick. It was like, because look, if I had to pick my favorite movie, I would say it's Die Hard. Like, but I feel like everybody talks about Die Hard. They all talk about it. It's always been my favorite movie. I had an AOL email address that was Die Hard and then three random numbers that they assigned me when I was in like seventh grade. And I was like, that was my email address. On AOL, and I've been obsessed with that movie. But that movie, Predator, Hunt for Red October, and then Die Hard with a Vengeance. Like, John McTiernan is my favorite director, and I work as a director, and I have completely, I'm obsessed with his philosophy on how to shoot things. And I apply it to whatever genre. It doesn't even matter if it's not action, because I just think the way he tells the story with the camera is really just, I just think he's the greatest and most underrated director. The way that he blocks scenes and shoots is really beautiful and amazing. And just geography is so clear. And he tells the story with the camera. It's really visual and amazing. And so anyway, I just love McTiernan. And so I probably would have picked Die Hard, but I was like, you know, everybody talks about Die Hard. I think I want to talk about Hunt for October, especially because it relates to the new movie, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, which I don't know if we want to get into spoilers or not, probably not, but it relates. Let's just say that.
Well, there's an actual reference to it. Yeah.
True. In the opening scene, there's a reference. Because there's this amazing moment in Hunt for Red October where, near the beginning of the movie, where Sean Connery and another actor are speaking Russian to each other. And then the camera zooms in on the other actor's face as he's reading a quote. And then when it gets to his lips, then he suddenly starts to speak English instead. It's on the word Armageddon. On the word Armageddon, it switches to English. And then the camera zooms back out, and then the rest of the scene plays in English. And all the scenes in the Russian submarine are now in English. And it's just a really amazing, fun language trick to just be, to get past the idea that it's a movie. We don't need to have these people speaking bad Russian the whole time. We can just get through this. We don't need subtitles. Let's just make it. Let's just get through it. McTiernan does that stuff with language a lot. It's really a really cool thing that he's done. There's an incredible sequence in 13th Warrior where he does that, where he like actually makes it a story beat, where there's a character learning language, and Antonio Banderas' character is learning this like Viking language, and it's a whole montage. And so like he like took that and took it a step further in that movie. It's really cool.
I did go back after rewatching The Hunt for Red October and watch how they did this in Valkyrie, since that was Tom Cruise and McKean's,
yeah, they also did that in Valkyrie. First.
Yeah, but I love the way they do it in Red October much more, where in Valkyrie it's narrating and he's writing in his journal. It also like is like a couple sentences and then it shifts away. I kind of imagine my dad, who was a big Tom Clancy fan, like most dads, I guess, of a certain age, I imagine him going to watch this movie and being concerned, like Sean Connery saying a couple words in Russian and being like, this is a 2.5 hour movie almost. Like, is this going to be this way the whole way?
when I watched Dead Reckoning before watching Hunt for Red October. So then as I sat down the last week to watch Hunt for Red October, it was like that Naked Gun, like forehead slapping gif that you see all the time. Like, oh, like this is why it was chosen. It's like fairly obvious, but I love these movies. Like this is like the quintessential like dad cinematic franchise. These Tom Clancy movies. These are the ones that I always remember seeing growing up. You know, like Harrison Ford doing that dive from an explosion that I feel like I've seen in 10 different movies, and he's probably Jack Ryan in all of them. So, I mean, this is like a huge part of people of a certain age. I feel like these movies. Would you agree, Drew?
Yeah, I mean, and the other connection too, right, is that Henry Cerny played a very Kittredge-esque character in Clear and Present Danger, which was just a couple of years before, maybe the year before they shot the first Mission Impossible. And he is also in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, exclusively in theaters right now. I think that this was a great pick. Charles and I talk about this movie a lot and how it's kind of had this influence over culture, but is not very frequently talked about, especially like Star Trek 2009 is like a total, like they kind of take their whole kind of design language and film language from this movie, from watching the ship being constructed on land to kind of the lens flares and the way the camera moves inside the Enterprise. It's kind of this underrated Rosetta Stone for a lot of modern action, but is rarely talked about in that kind of elevated echelon of movies from that period. So I just love it. And that score.
The score, oh my God, Basil Polidori's. But another connection too to Dead Reckoning Part 1 is, which I think is really fun to consider putting these movies side by side, is ILM doing the visual effects for Red October and then doing some submarine visual effects for the new Mission Impossible movie to see that progression. Because I think I love the visual effects in Red October and they still hold up to me. I think they're amazing. But to see now, like the way that they do the submarine and they can get the way the visual effects are really wonderful. They like they get into the details of like, you know, shooting out the countermeasures or flooding the submarine tubes. I feel like I haven't seen those kinds of things in such detail visually in a movie before about with submarines. And so it's cool to see that in the new one.
Yeah, I think that they came on Red October fairly late too. I think that Dream Quest was originally the visual effects supervisors or the visual effects company, and they came in late and did an amazing job with the models in a tank full of smoke.
Yeah, we talked
and
to somebody.
Now we have these crazy.
Who was it? Was it John Knoll? Who did we talk to on the old version? Because we had, you know, now that we're official, we have relaunched, but our old show's got 200 episodes. And one of them, we talked to somebody from ILM who worked, and they talked about how they were shooting it in some old factory that was like moldy or something, right?
Yeah.
All those giant model submarines. I want to say it was John Knoll.
Yeah, the effects hold up really well, I feel like, on this rewatch. It doesn't feel dated at all. I was like, this looks legit. I believe this.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, like the design of the Red October's interior versus the American sub. And, you know, it's, it's just a wonderful film. We're going long. We got to get to the next movie.
Oh, I did actually want to point one thing out to Charles's point about language. And something that I think is very underrated about McTiernan is how much patience he has with supporting characters and kind of letting them have an introductory scene where they kind of get to talk about something that maybe doesn't even tie into the larger narrative. I'm thinking specifically with this one, Courtney B. Vance during the training session with the sonar, and how they start to, he gets kind of chided. Slim is the person who will like give me guff and slack. He's nice with me on here, but so I kind of liked this like working on the sub where they're kind of giving each other shit. And it's like this long story that the supporting character is given, but it's also interrupted and it's never gone back to. I feel like modern movies, they always just go back to the specific line that someone is saying, or tell me the rest of that story. The way that it comes back is like, he is talking about music, which comes back when he hears Russian singing, but it's not like a direct correlation. And I like that all of that is in this scene. Even though it's not one of the main characters, it's kind of like this great camaraderie scene. And McTiernan like has so many of those in Die Hard.
Yeah, Courtney B. Vance is amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
I always just wonder if there was really a roll of toilet paper next to the kind of console. Are people sweating? Are they spilling their drinks?
The sweat is off the charts. Yeah. I don't know how people do it on a submarine. I wouldn't be able to survive 10 minutes down there.
No way.
The kind of funk going on for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
Good heavens. next on our list, The Wrong Trousers, 1993, Nick Park, 4.2 average on Letterboxd. This was, again, a first-time watch for me, and this is one of those, like, dumb, how come you haven't watched this before? Mm-hmm. Because all my friends are, like, 4.5 stars, 5 stars on Letterboxd. So this is Drew's pick. Grommet finds himself being pushed out of his room and home by a new lodger who is actually a ruthless criminal. The Penguin is planning a robbery and needs to use Wallace and his mechanical remote-controlled trousers to pull off the raid. However, Grommet is wise to the Penguin and comes to the rescue. Wallace and Grommet, The Wrong Trousers. Drew, why this one?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, it has a heavy Hitchcock influence. Obviously, Feathers McGraw, the Penguin in question, is very much like the lodger from the Hitchcock movie. But also, it has a great train sequence. And recently, when we talked to Simon Pegg, he equated the making of one of these movies to the climax where Grommet is putting down track as the locomotive is barreling towards certain doom. So for all of those reasons, and the fact that it is one of my favorite films ever, I think it lines up very, very well. And it also inspired my second pick, which we will get to.
Yeah, some of these were like this one. On the podcast, we've had movies that are like hard to find, but this one, it's like a bummer that like this one isn't kind of like readily available.
Yeah,
like
won an Oscar. You know? Yeah, I have a Blu-ray somewhere that I like treasure because it's so out of print.
I pulled out my Blu-ray, so I can openly say it's there.
We had real foresight. I mean, why it's out of print is a mystery. But
yeah, I mean, I'm all about dog cinema. We talk about it on the show all the time. We're living in a golden age of dog cinema. But Wallace and Gromit, everything Aardman does is amazing, and the Wallace and Gromit, everything that they've done with Wallace and Gromit is amazing. Like Curse of the Were-Rabbit's incredible too. I love. Drew and I are both big dog people, so we're big fans.
Yeah, Grommet is a huge dog an icon of dog cinema.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
Towering giant.
Dom Watches left a review on Letterboxd. I watched this with my year 7-8 students and we all audibly gasped when the penguin pulls out a revolver on Gromit. What an absurd half hour of pure imagination. That captures it right there.
Yeah.
I love that his disguise is a rubber glove that he puts on his head and makes people think he's a chicken. And I like when he kind of rubs the glove back. Yes. And it kind of springs forward. Yeah. That is just beautiful.
I think my favorite penguin moment is when he was trying out the bed for taking over Gromit's room. Like, he has a master plan to rob. I mean, he also needs to catch his Z's, so he's got to make sure that bed works out well for him. There is also a, I mean, you could say that maybe there's inspiration from the first Mission Impossible here with the laser jewel heist section.
From
how Tom Cruise famously went down. So not just the train. Yes. It's all Gromit all over Mission Impossible.
Oh, love it.
You mentioned the comment from Simon about the like leaving the track as the train is moving.
Yes.
And in prep for the Mission Impossible, the new one. So backstory, I'm a huge Tom fan, I'm a huge Mission Impossible fan. Fallout is like the best action, you know, finale for that era of Mission Impossible movies that they ever could have done. So I'm a huge fan. So I was listening to the audio commentaries recently, and I was listening to the one, I think Macquarie and Tom sat down for Rogue Nation. And it was like my first reminder about how Macquarie works, in that so much of the production of these movies is like, for lack of a better phrase, like on the fly. Like they'll do it while they're filming, they're rewriting things, they're still planning. And I got that impression while listening to the backlog and the newer episodes. It's kind of like, it's almost like they now trust in Tom and Macquarie that, yeah, we'll have an outline for a movie. We'll figure it out as we go. We'll get this done towards the end. And my question to you both is, did that surprise you at all in like your journey going through the Mission movies to see how Macquarie and Tom work over time and put these movies together, Drew?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the old show in particular is really fun because you kind of get the Rashomon view of the production of every one of these movies because we talked to so many people. But I think that what Charles and I have sort of discovered is that there's this misconception that it's messy or that it's, you know, haphazard or something, but it really is the most amazingly controlled, confident production. It's just that this is their process and this is the way that they do it. And they make great movies like this. So there's no reason that anyone should doubt them. And even when we visited set of 8 last year, which we will not be able to talk about until God knows when next year, but just seeing how small the production was, but how highly motivated everyone is and how on the ball everyone is in terms of their character and the meaning of the scene and the larger production. So that's really was the interesting thing, is like you hear how they're made and you think, oh my God, this is just pure chaos, but it's not really. It's really just a methodology that they've applied to these productions that end up paying off. Like, these are great movies.
I mean, that's how Die Hard was made. Die Hard was made with 30 pages of script. And John McTiernan gets there on set with the writer and the Joel Silver's a part of it as well, the producer, and Jan de Bont, the cinematography, and all these amazing actors, and they're finding the movie as they go. They made it up as they went along. That's why, like, when the bad guys show up at the beginning, when Hans Gruber and his cronies come out of the back of the truck, there's no ambulance there, and then, because they didn't know how they were going to escape. And then in the middle of making the movie, they were like, how are we going to get them out of this building? What's their scheme? They're like, oh, we'll have them get an ambulance is in the truck. But they'd already filmed the part where the bad guys come out and there's no ambulance there. So they just had to have an ambulance, because they're just making it up as they went along. It was the same kind of thing. I mean, there are a lot of movies. So when we interviewed Tom recently, he talked about that like some of his favorite movies, Casablanca and other ones they mentioned, that he and Macquarie mentioned. That's how he's like, that's how movies.
There's another movie that he's seen.
Yeah, we got three now.
Got three. And they just talk about how movies are like a living, breathing organism. And they're trying to, I mean, you think about Alan Rickman in Die Hard and how incredible he is. If they had written a role for him, if he had come in and just played a role, maybe it wouldn't have been Alan Rickman that we know if they didn't tailor it for him. And that's what Cruise and McCrory are trying to do, and you feel that in that new movie as well.
With every role.
Yeah. They're trying to bring out from within the people they cast, as opposed to putting something on the exterior and throw it on somebody.
Is that how you film movies, Charles?
I don't have the luxury. I was going
to
say,
you saw what happened when Charles tried to read a line of that was pre-written. That's what would happen.
The movie I'm going to direct this. We'll see when the movie will go into production now, but was going to go into production in a few weeks. That I had 18 shooting days, so I don't really have the luxury of finding it as we go.
Yes, 30 seconds of experimentation allowed for every shooting day.
Per day, they clock me. And say, okay, here's your 30 seconds.
Right.
But I think there are lessons that can be taken from it. I mean, there's so much that we've learned from hearing them talk about just being open to it. Just everything that's happened now with SAG strike and how this movie is shut down. We interviewed McCrory and Cruise and the cast in New York a few days ago. And afterwards, I just said to McHugh, I was like, hey, man, I'm going to make this movie up in New York if you have any last minute advice before I get thrown into this. And he's like, oh, that's great. It's like, just so you know, because it was sort of feeling like, okay, the SAG strike's probably going to happen. He's like, and he's talked about this publicly in relation to Fallout and when Tom Cruise's ankle was broken. He's like, just realize that any of these setbacks that come up, like if SAG strike shuts everything down, like it's just an opportunity to make the movie better. And it's just like you get more time to you'll look back on it. He said you'll look back on it afterwards and you'll realize, oh my God, that was the best thing that could have happened because it'll make things better. And just also his whole approach to molding scenes and things to locations, as opposed to trying to force the scene that is written on the page into it's like working from like there's multiple scenes in the movie that we're shooting in upstate New York. And I'm instead of trying to find this specific bridge for this one scene where this romantic thing happens, it's like, it doesn't have to be a bridge. It could be anything. Like, let's go around the town. Let's go find spots that feel like can inform this scene and make it. So those things, those lessons still apply even on a smaller scale like this.
Don't let bridges discourage you is the important thing.
But it's like, instead of trying to find the perfect bridge that we imagined in our minds, I wrote it with my writing partner, Seth. It's like, instead of thinking that it has to be that, it's like, it could be anything. It could be, whatever we find that works, that speaks to us and speaks to the story and the characters.
Well, that's great advice from McHugh. I'm actually realizing we've all had the pleasure of talking with McHugh on this call. He's a very, very, very good interview, but bring up bridges. This is the perfect bridge to to where we're going from here, which is talking
great
Mission
transition.
Impossible.
Really smooth.
Dead Reckoning Part 1.
You hear that, Paramount? We can do it too, okay?
But did you say that it's exclusively in theaters right now and that people should probably go see the premium format option, whatever it is? Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I mentioned Fallout, and Fallout, I had like a religious experience seeing in theaters. It was like the perfect end cap to so many plot threads. Was not expecting it. So I went into Dead Reckoning kind of like, assuming that we're going to get like a fresh start. Maybe this is kind of like a new chapter for this franchise. How did you both approach what to expect with Dead Reckoning as kind of like fans of the franchise? Because Fallout is like, it's hard to top, you know?
Fallout is a masterpiece for sure. I think we were just really excited about what was new about this one, right? Like, it's the first one that has been shot digitally. It's a new cinematographer. McCrory has kind of a whole new outlook on how he shot the movie philosophically and technically, and also, how that would impact Eddie Hamilton's editing, who we love. And we just talked to him on the podcast. So look for that coming up soon.
He's a lot of fun, that guy.
He's the best. He's the absolute best.
Yeah.
So I think we were just excited about, we started the podcast right before Fallout. So we've kind of been with it this whole time. It was really interesting to see. We'd seen a little bit of the movie from going to CinemaCon and, stuff that we kind of picked up on set. But it was a largely new experience for us. And we just were just thrilled to have all of that 2 hours and 34 minutes of new Mission Impossible goodness.
Yeah, it's so hard because... we've talked to so many people who work on these movies, and so it was completely, and also everyone on social media just sends us everything that has to do with this movie. So it's like, there was no way we could go in with no expectations and like not knowing some things. And so it was a very unique, probably the most unique movie going experience I've had in that way, where it was just like, there's so much built on top of this first watch that it was, it was really, it was interesting. And also, I mean, we're just, now that we were so steeped in all of the Mission Impossible franchise, it's like just knowing every single thing and, you know, it's, I don't know, it's, but I was surprised by how different it felt, you know? I mean, McCrory really, with each of the three movies he's done in this series now, they're all totally different. It's really wild. It's like, because that was the thing that was so unique to us about this franchise, and part of why we started the podcast before Fallout came out was like, each one of these movies has a different director with a completely different approach. I mean, we both are just, we adore Brian De Palma and we adore Brad Bird. And, you know, and of course we love John Woo and J.J. Abrams too. It's like, it's seeing everybody's approach is totally different for each movie. And it was so unique to be like, all right, well, now that we have a returning director for Fallout, what's that going to be like? But McCrory has like taken this approach, which makes him feel like a different director with each one that he's done. And it's even continued now with this one, where this one feels like the tone is a lot, I mean, there's some very serious stuff in it too, and some emotional things for sure. But overall, the tone is like looser and funnier. It almost feels like the best of the Roger Moore, James Bond movies. Like it's almost feels like Spy Who Loved Me-esque or something, you know? I mean, like it's really interesting. I think it might be the funniest one.
Oh yeah.
Disagree. 100%. Ghost Protocol is still funnier. Ghost Protocol is still funnier.
Yeah, Renner stretching in those pants.
Yeah, next time I get to seduce the bad guy. There's nothing like that in this one. You know,
what did you think sitting down to watch this, Brian?
Well, I guess I haven't been on record like everyone else here yet saying I agree. I think Fallout is a masterpiece. This is also my favorite. The Mission films are my favorite film movie franchise in my life. So I mean, I just expected that.
Us too.
Yeah.
And you can watch the previous Mission movies right now on Paramount Plus, streaming on
they're all
on
streaming
devices
on Paramount Plus
today.
Right now, yeah.
So yeah, I was looking forward to having some fun and I had that. And I think to the point, like this one was goofier throughout in ways that I really, really liked. Like the early scene where they're kind of explaining what IMF means and what that force is, yeah. and the government building, and everyone's like, this is the most ridiculous thing that I've heard. I loved the you can't talk about this movie without the tiny car, and I did love going back to like sparing a beat in an action movie. I really liked the slow machinations of that, of him trying to figure it out. I put in my notes, might edit this out, but the way that scene played out was kind of like a bedroom scene if the husband has ED.
That conceptual joke is like one of the funniest, if not the funniest thing in the whole series. I think it's so good. I like die laughing every time. It's so funny.
And he's so ashamed, and it's like the perfect kind of like action joke of like stopping because he can't figure this like person who was going to save the world can't figure out how to start the car.
She's so supportive in that moment. It's so funny.
Oh yeah.
She's so good.
Just like an ED commercial. That's what I'm saying.
Well, about that car too, I almost picked the castle of Cagliostro as one of my four picks, but we had McHugh, I think during production, shoot down that as being a reference for Mission Impossible. Dead Reckoning Part 1. But still, tiny Fiat, yellow Fiat that gets into all sorts of hijinks, and very much recommended. Yeah.
I think this has maybe some of the most beautiful scenes in the franchise as well. Like the scene before the bridge, before he comes upon the bridge and he's running through the alleys with the light behind him. Like I watched it a second time this past week and those scenes jumped out at me like right away. Like the hallway fight
feels
scene.
Feels kind of like a shot from Nomads, huh?
Oh, and that's the list.
Throwing it back to old school, very old John McTiernan. That's like the one shot from Nomads that's really amazing. It's like Pierce Brosnan running down the alley with that light behind him. It feels kind of similar.
Yeah, Charles, that's the only image anyone remembers from Nomads. It was in the trailer. It was on the poster. It was the only thing anybody remembers from Nomads.
I just had to bring up Nomads. It's just not brought up.
We're going to make a special John McTiernan list, I think, from this episode of movies Charles brings up during the conversation.
That's all I talk about. There's nothing else. I guess Mission, that's it.
If we're talking about Venice, I did want to just also mention, while highlighting kind of the fun, goofy stuff and all the action, I mean, it did make me a little emotional, when they're in Venice and Ilsa, Rebecca Ferguson, and Tom, Ethan Hunt, they realize I can't remember who says it first, but they said, "I haven't been to Venice." And then the other one says, "I haven't either." And then they go on a gondola and they hold hands and it's like, oh yeah, you know, like I loved that moment. The music is great. I love those two characters. And I just kind of, I guess my main takeaway is, in these action movies, I love when everything pauses to do something that has nothing to do with anything else. And that's what makes it more than an action movie to me, is these kind of little beats. And I love that.
Nothing more than an action movie than Police Story 3 Supercop, 1992. 3.6 average on Letterboxd. This is Charles' pick. There's never a cop around when you need one, but when this cop's around,
one is all you need.
Jackie Chan, this is maybe one of my earliest, probably like black market DVDs that I remember buying as a kid.
Well, and now there's a beautiful 4K from 88 Films that just came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
great.
That is beautiful. Stunning. Yeah.
I have the Criterion Laserdisc, actually. I don't even have a Laserdisc player, but I just have that because I was like, oh, man, it's so good. I Rumble in the Bronx was a very big deal to me. That movie came out when I was 12, I want to say, and I saw it and became instantly obsessed. That trailer, like, blew me away. And then Supercop was, I think, the second movie that they put out in America after that, after, like, Rumble in the Bronx was such a success. And that trailer and the line that you read about, you know, there's never a cop around when you need one, but when this cop's around, one is all you need. That was in the trailer, and like, it's just those trailers are just, I go back and watch them all the time. But even before the movie came out theatrically, after I saw Rumble in the Bronx, I got so obsessed that I ordered these bootleg VHSs. There was some company, I can't remember what it was, but there's some catalog that I was ordering these. Like, I ordered a bunch of Jackie Chan movies on VHS that were just like the uncut Hong Kong versions. And which now finally is like available here, because for a long time is it Miramax who did the Supercop release in America, where they like put a bunch of rap music in it and they sold a soundtrack, and you know, at least it was Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh who do the dubbing for it, which is good. But
did they do the rapping, or
they didn't do the rapping? But Jackie does have a very big singing career, you know, but he didn't rap.
Yeah, I do know that. Yeah, you've played me some very questionable songs in the past.
I was obsessed. I love these movies. I almost went with Police Story 1. I think it's a better movie overall, probably, but because of the connections with Dead Reckoning Part 1, with Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh working together sort of and being at odds, and then also the big train finale, the last like 20 minutes of Supercop are just like maybe the greatest third act of any action movie. It's the most most jaw-dropping stunts and things from both of them. Just it's amazing. And it ends with a big fight on top of a train, just like we get with Dead Reckoning Part 1. So it's I'm just a gigantic Jackie Chan fan, and I had to go with Police Story 3 Supercop for its connection.
So good. I just rewatched the first Police Story with my wife, and I was texting Charles and I was like, oh, this movie is like an actual like masterpiece. Just everything about it is so good. He is really the only analog to Tom, maybe ever. And I love, you know, you talk about the comedy and like the way that Jackie just embraces comedy, and that the comedy never like undercuts the action or the stakes or the thrills. It's all just in service of the same kind of like wonderful tonal stew. I just love it. Yeah.
Was Rumble in the Bronx the stunt where he jumps from one building to the other buildings fire escape?
Yeah.
I remember seeing that as a kid and I almost like crap my pants. Yeah. Like that was the coolest thing.
There were
I'd
a lot
seen.
Of there was a crap a pants crapping epidemic at the time. I think I did. I saw that movie in the theaters and I loved seeing, you know, the beautiful
smells
of
shit
New York
everywhere.
Yeah. It was just seeing those beautiful the beautiful mountains of Manhattan in the background was just, you know, yes. It was too much for people.
Yeah, it is Rumble in Vancouver is really what it should be called. Yes, but that's okay. Yeah. It's okay. Nobody cares. No, they were trying to shoot around it. There's a funny, you read about this, I've read about this, I think it's on like IMDb trivia or whatever, but like Jackie Chan, they were like trying to shoot around the mountains and just like, we got to make it look at the Bronx. And then at a certain point, Jackie Chan was like, nobody cares. Just shoot the action. Who cares if there are mountains in the background?
Mm-hmm. That was the approach they took on this latest Scream movie too. The most Montreal looking New York City you've ever seen in your life.
Brian, did you grow up crapping your pants watching Jackie Chan movies?
I did not. Actually, I didn't really start watching Jackie Chan until recently. So Super Cop is new to me. And actually, the way that I remembered it is exactly what you're describing, Charles, through that advertisement. So I actually didn't know. I've seen the two Police Story movies, and I did not know that Super Cop was the third. I think
they have very strange naming conventions. And when they were domesticated, it's very, very weird. Charles could tell you all about the Armor of God and where that Operation Condor and. Yeah.
Armor of God came first and then Operation Condor. But when they released them in America, they released Operation Condor theatrically. It did well enough that then they released Armor of God, which was the first movie, as the second movie. So they released it as Operation Condor 2. Armor of God, it's like, didn't make any sense. They reversed them. It made no sense.
But yeah, I really liked this series a lot as well. I mean, the thing that does make me the closest to crapping my pants, I guess, and in these stunt movies, both Fallout and Super Cop do that. And that's more the hanging from the ladder off the helicopter. Because it's
oh my God.
It's not just like hanging off a flying object, I think, is always scary. I mean, I guess in Fallout, what was that? Like it was a net with laundry inside. What was in that? It looked like
those were marshmallows being delivered to they were making s'mores on the other children. Side of that mountain. Yeah.
Well, actually, it should be laundry because everyone's crapping their pants. That's why they got to take all that. They got to take all that laundry away because this stunt is gonna just full of diapers.
Was the Batman score in this one too? I heard the Danny Elfman Batman score
in the Hong Kong version. I don't know how they got away with it, I don't know how they're still getting away with it. Because I remember seeing it in the bootleg in the 90s and being like, wow, they've got Danny Elfman's Batman score in the finale. They keep like playing little bits of it. I don't know how they're still getting away with it.
Yeah, it's on the Criterion app. I remember because I was watching it. I was like, should this still be in this version of the movie on the Criterion channel right now?
Don't worry about it.
I don't know.
Criterion, turn the volume down on this episode if you're listening, please. Yeah, they're great stunts. Michelle's split jump. I can't remember if it was the truck or she's on the train and like something comes up against it. You grow up watching these movies and you always remember seeing the outtakes at the end in the credits. Like, I think I remember even like fast forwarding through some movies, like, I got to see the outtakes first just before I even watch the movie. But I want to say like it's a lost art.
Yeah, we call that the cannon. Like these people cannonball are like almost dying effect where you put you put the outtakes, you know. You see,
we need to go back.
Do you have a favorite? What's your favorite outtakes at the end of a movie, Slim?
My favorite ones are like, unfortunately for Jackie, the ones where he gets hurt and his team has to like rub the injury.
They're always over there rubbing his chest or rubbing his leg. Yeah, that's gonna save it.
Ooh, that's always the Jackie Chan. Yeah,
yeah. There was the one in this one. He got hit by the helicopter when he was spinning, and like right away they had to like cut him down from that gurney. And he looked like he was in real pain for that one.
Rumble in the Bronx is a good one because he breaks his foot or his ankle when he jumped onto that hovercraft. But then they didn't stop shooting. They didn't shut down. He has a cast on, and then he puts on this like special like rubber
sneaker
thing around to make it look like he's wearing a sneaker. And he just keeps doing stunts and like with it with a broken foot, like it's a broken ankle. It's crazy.
I'm glad somebody finally utilized the famous New York City hovercraft. As well. Everybody, when they think of New York, they just think of...
Brian, do you have a favorite stunt?
Well, actually, I was going to bring up the bloopers at the end of this, but in a different way, because they're... So, I mean, I think the most unexpected thing about this entire movie, to me, is like kind of how there's these moments of... There's these political moments, basically, where because Hong Kong is about to transition from... from being a British colony back to China. And there's a joke at the there's little things throughout the movie, but there's a joke at the very end of the movie where Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh are arguing about where the money should go, and he says like, put it in the Hong Kong account, because by 1997 you're just going to take it anyway. So, and then like, but it cuts so abruptly to the bloopers, like kind of like people were nervous that this joke was even in there. It's kind of like nothing to see here. It is the Leslie Nielsen nothing to see here thing about
Charles. You have done some research into this.
Well, I think it's in that 88 films Blu-ray, right? Isn't there an essay written about it where someone talks about how Jackie's kind of, that this movie was a nexus point where he kind of, his political beliefs sort of shifted in the way that they, you know, kind of appear in his movies. Like that he was more of a Hong Kong cop person. And then like after this, it's more mainland China. I don't know. Yeah, there's an essay that I will not be able to speak to it as well as that essay is written. So I'm not going to get
88 films Blu-ray. Read it for yourself.
Yeah. Get back to Wait, is it Fortune about, Star? Yeah. Or is that another version? I feel like
I think that's the other version. You bought like two versions in the past like 8 months.
I know. It's crazy. This is like we are living in like quite the time for Jackie Chan's movies like getting big releases. I mean, like Gorgeous just got a crazy, beautiful looking release. That's like it's a pretty good movie.
That's not but a
it's
great
not,
movie.
Not really what's not one of his best. And what else? There's Dragons Forever just got a great release. I can't remember who did that one, but that's a really beautiful
Hand of Death
one.
Just got came out from Arrow, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're living in a boutique Blu-ray renaissance.
And now there's a much Jackie Chan box sets too. There's those from his earlier movies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, those are so good. Shout
Is that Shout
out,
Factory? Yeah. Just those are great too. So yeah, it's really an amazing time. So yeah, there have been like four releases of the Police Story movies in the last couple of years, and I just buy them all.
It's like Texas Chainsaw. I feel like there's a Texas Chainsaw re-release like every 6 months from some boutique vendor.
Yeah,
everyone
we have to support them. They're as Guillermo said, media is a moral imperative. I have to bring that up.
Our final film, The Lone Ranger, 2013, Gore Verbinski. This is Drew's pick. It's got a 2.6 average
Ouch.
On Letterboxd right
ouch.
Now.
Oh, Drew. Oh, boy.
It's ripe for some people to discover this film. The Texas Rangers chase down a gang of outlaws led by Butch Cavendish, but the gang ambushes the Rangers, seemingly killing them all. And you know the rest of the story for The Lone Ranger. But this is like a much maligned film, The Lone Ranger. This is one that I had never seen.
Okay.
So when this came over in our email, I was like, "Whoa, okay, we're finally gonna watch Lone Ranger." And
you're being forced at gunpoint.
Yeah, it's like it's like you were given a horrible medical diagnosis. I'm sorry, sir.
I mean, you could say that with the cast of this movie, the decisions made. You could. I mean, I don't think I was wrong.
Whoa.
However, this movie is a hoot. Like, this is a lot of fun. I was shocked how gorgeous this movie was. The beginning and the ending stunts are, like, legit insane. So, Drew, this is quite a pick.
Well, yeah, I love this movie. I love gore. And I also love sort of much maligned Disney movies. Last year, I wrote 12,000 words on the making of John Carter. So if anyone wants to look that up, and you have about an hour and a half on your hands, go ahead and read that. But yeah, I just think it is a beautiful movie. It totally like goes for broke in ways that many studio movies don't. And it's totally gorgeous looking, and it commits to the weird tone like few things do. And the reason I chose it was I think until Dead Reckoning Part One, it was maybe the greatest or my favorite train sequence ever, which is the climax. It's about the last 30 minutes of the movie, and it is absolutely one of the most insane things that you'll ever see. I mean, it was if you watch the behind the scenes stuff, just how they pulled it off is really, really impressive and really insane. As much CGI as there is, they were still dragging, you know, train cars through the woods. And you know, I really appreciate his level of kind of clarity and kind of spatial awareness that all of his action sequences have. So, you know, Tonto's on one train, the Lone Ranger is running beside another, the kid's on the, you know, it's like, there's a lot going on for sure. And it is definitely 100 pounds of shit in a 10 pound bag, but oh, I love it. I just love it so much.
Charles, do you agree with that sentiment?
I think I respect it more than I love it. I don't know the last time I've watched it. I think I've seen it once, maybe twice. But the thing I'll say about it is that it really goes for it. Gore Verbinski goes for it. I think he's an amazing filmmaker. And this is a Disney studio released movie where, is it William Fichtner who's the bad guy?
Yeah.
He carves out someone's heart, and we see that in the reflection of somebody's eyeball. That's something that happens in this movie. And he eats it in the reflection of somebody's eyeball. That's a scene in this movie. That's something that I'll never forget. And I think about that. I think I just sit and think about it sometimes.
I think it was like, one of the first movies.
How did they let him do that? I'm always fascinated by movies like that where it's so much money and all these resources were put into something. And I just, how did they get away with this? You know, I love movies like that.
And so who was it for? Who was a $250 million Western made in whatever year it was, 2013? Who was that supposed to appeal to?
It's almost like he built up his cachet with the Pirates movies.
Yes. And the marketing.
Look what I did here.
All the marketing is basically like, it's Pirates on Land. And it's like,
Yeah,
except that there's a sequence before the third act where an entire indigenous population is massacred by a railroad company. Mm-hmm. And the bad guy is kind of like the modern progress of the railroad. I mean, it's just such an abstract, kind of insane idea to put in a movie. And God bless him for it.
I always respect a fucking crazy swing that someone can just go into the studios, get a couple hundred million dollars to make a movie and get away with it and just get out of there with this crazy movie. I love stuff like that. There's a movie that I end up watching on, I always have it downloaded on my iPad and I watch it all the time, is Your Highness. Like, obviously Pineapple Express is way better and I love it. And I love David Gordon Green's earlier stuff as well. Of course, All the Real Girls was a really important movie to me, but Your Highness, I would go back to and watch all the time because I'm always just like, how did they let them make this?
Oh my God, I forgot about this movie. 2.2 on Letterboxd right now for Your Highness.
Oh, come on, people. Give it another shot.
We need to get that Lone Ranger number up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, jeez.
I'd prefer
Brian, I think you might have had a similar viewing experience to me, right, when you watched this?
Yeah, well, first I'll say, Your Highness is my lowest rated watch of this year. I will say that, but I was I gave it the rare half star.
The puppet.
Wow.
Oh my god.
But I was very surprised by The Lone Ranger, and I actually probably never would have seen it without the homework from this. So I appreciate that. It also kind of
welcome.
True, this is a hit. You're doing so well. I mean, we can get the ratings up now. I hope.
But I also watched it kind of like the exact right time because I literally had just finished reading David Grand's Killers of the Flower Moon, which will obviously be a Scorsese movie later this year. And there was a lot of ideas. The most appealing part of The Lone Ranger to me, for all the action and how great Gore Verbinski is with action, is how it's this epic giant budget movie that's revisionist Western, that's about the corruption at every level that is taking advantage of Native Americans. Now, I know that part of the reason why this rating is very low, there's many reasons, I think, like just like to the point of you guys bringing up that like people think that the mission movies are sloppy or messy because you read stuff about how they're making up the script on spot. I think like all of the pre-production over budget, bloated, like all of that. Plus, you can't get around this that, it is unfortunate that Johnny Depp is Tonto as far as casting goes, but it's also kind of contradictory within the movie because the movie is kind of one of the most Native American forward movies that have ever been made in Hollywood. And so like he's caked in makeup and like I see him like in the flashback scenes, because there is a framing device that I loved the framing device, but there is a framing device within a museum of old Tonto. But the young one I kind of just see Jack Sparrow with the eyes and the facial reactions, but Johnny Depp does melt away in the flash forward scenes. But it also like reinforces the like this, you know, it'd be so much better if
literally anyone
if this was a Native.
Well,
American.
I mean, Army Hammer's not doing us any favors either on this one.
Oh, brother.
But I think that people should give it a chance because it has, with those uncomfortable things aside, like it is a very, very, very well made movie. And I think that it has so many of the, there's so many things that are kind of correct about it. It just has, you know, to $250 million movie. I mean, if, you know, maybe Johnny Depp should have been the Lone Ranger. I think that's what something that you thought.
Yeah. Slim. Well, after I saw Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which I will never disparage a movie that is in competition with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 in theaters exclusively right now, I did call Charles and I said, can you imagine if Gore Verbinski had made Indiana Jones?
Oh, what that would have been. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That would have been nuts.
Yeah.
Or Brad Bird, too. Would have been really wonderful, too, I think.
Cripes. I was thinking of who would have been a Lone Ranger casting. I mean, what was Michael Cera up to? When Michael Lone Ranger was being filmed. Can you imagine Michael Cera as the Lone Ranger in that movie? Movie magic. That's what that means to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Michael Cera.
Okay, so we're rapidly running out of time. The podcast.
Wait, we need one more Tom Cruise. We got three Tom Cruise. What's another movie that Tom Cruise brought up?
Fourth one.
What else did he bring up, Charles? I mean,
I like that we can position this episode as Tom didn't give us the four faves, so we went to the source.
Yeah. We know that the great Waldo Pepper influenced 8. Can we tease that? That is an element of 8.
That's a pretty good tease.
I want to know what everybody's top 4 are right now.
Like legit four faves?
Your four faves on your Letterboxd account.
Okay. Mine number 1 right now, and I said this to Tom, is Vanilla Sky.
Okay.
Keep going. RoboCop.
Okay.
After Yang.
Okay.
Interstellar.
Oh, wow. That's a recent one. Couple of recent ones. Wow. Okay.
Charles, what about you? Where are you, Charles?
What are mine right now on there? I like to shift it every week because I have too many favorite movies.
So do I.
But I think I actually have Hunt for October on here. I always like to have at least one McTiernan movie on here. So I always have one. So Hunt for October, The Birdcage, Victor Victoria, and I have The First Police Story right now. But like I said, it rotated. Like every couple of weeks, I'm just like, what am I feeling? What are my four favorites? You know, Truman Show gets in there a lot.
What about you, Brian? Okay, Charles, we get it.
This is what Drew is
trying to get people's lists right now.
Paper Moon in the first position.
Nice.
Peter Bogdanovich movie.
That's a Paramount title.
Named after it. It is a Paramount title. And it
needs a big anniversary, actually.
You need a Blu-ray, whichever physical media people are listening to this.
I think there is something coming out. Oh, yeah, there isn't one, is there? Maybe there's one coming out. I don't remember at this point, but yeah.
So Paper Moon, then Point Blank, the Lee Marvin 60s crime caper. Marie Antoinette. I got a soft spot for that movie. And then Throwdown by Johnny Toe.
Wow.
If you haven't seen it, which is a great martial arts movie. It's martial arts with friends. It's actually kind of perfect with Mission Impossible movies because it's basically about you become friends by beating people up with other people.
Ooh, Charles, this might be something that can expand our circle, our social circles of beating people up.
Well, also Point Blank.
I do have to call out, my friend just sent me this. Truman Show 4K.
Yes, I just got that. I just watched it.
Oh, just rewatched it this week. 5 stars.
Another Paramount title.
Another Paramount title. You can get that right now.
Point Blank. There's a reference to Point Blank in Mission Impossible Fallout.
I think Point Blank is Paramount too. Is it not?
There's some kind of there's a theme forming here. I'm only just now seeing it.
All right, Drew's 4.
Okay, all right.
You can't get away.
In no particular order. In no particular order. Charles, you already saw these. Streets of Fire. Looker by Michael Crichton.
Yeah, I love Looker. Looker is amazing. Seen, yeah.
Yeah. Porco Rosso by, of course, our Miyazaki-san. And what is my fourth one? To Live and Die in L.A., which I rewatched over the pandemic and realized it was one of the great movies perhaps ever.
I saw that in 35 a few weeks ago in LA. It was amazing.
The future of Light the Fuse. What can the fans expect in the coming weeks and months.
The future is bright. Let me tell you what the future is. The future is great interviews with top talent in front of and behind the camera. The future is perhaps a miniseries or a few little segments devoted to the upcoming Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which you can also only exclusively see in theaters starting on August 2nd. And is, I think, one of me and Charles's favorite movies of the year, even if we were not semi-employed by the parent company. It is an absolute delight.
I was surprised because Drew is a very big animation guy. If you want information about all things animation, Drew writes wonderful articles, interviews, and things with people related to animation. And he, you know, he's a little, to me, sometimes he can be a little biased for some animation movies. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, he's like, it's so good. He saw it at Annecy, which is the animation festival. And I was like, okay, Drew, all right, great. Mm. And then he took me to, we went to a press screening a few weeks ago. It wasn't even finished. And I was blown away. It's so funny and great. Like, they use Jackie Chan, bringing it back to Jackie Chan. Jackie plays Splinter. And they use him in ways that nobody is, like, brought out sides of him. And like, he's so funny. And there's a really great heart to it as well. And, like, you can feel that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg had a blast writing lines of dialogue for Jackie Chan to say. It's so funny.
And the Nine Inch Nails score is, like, unbelievably great.
Oh, my God.
Trenton Atticus did amazing music for it as well.
You might be getting a little Light the Ooze action in the not-too-distant future. And, we are just going to keep on plugging. I mean, theoretically, we have part two coming out in June of next year, and we have a lot of people to talk to and a lot of things to dig into for this one. So the future, I think the future is looking pretty bright.
We're still hunting people too. We're hunting down John Woo.
Not physically.
Really, not physically yet. But we do want to talk to John Woo in an interview setting and then hunt him with bows and arrows. it starts with an interview. And then Danny Elfman, Hans Zimmer, J.J. Abrams. We're always chasing these people, the ones that got away. You know, we got some white whales in our original run, but we're still chasing.
Yeah, we have some missed connections that we need to follow up on. We saw them on the subway. They got out of stop before us, and now we're just kind of chasing after them. Yeah.
Once they see that Paramount subject line, they're like, well, all right, let's talk.
Or they'll just turn away even quicker. Who knows? Who knows?
The one thing I was going to ask, so I was looking up set photos of 8. Because I needed to see, based on Simon's comments about Tom's hair, I needed to see what the hair looked like.
Oh, yeah, and it looks real good.
I've never seen this length of Tom hair in this franchise, or really, maybe recently at all.
Yeah, it's close to 4. It's really long, but it is beautifully styled, and if you thought 7 was nuts, 8 is like, I don't even know how to describe it. 8 is going to be so insane that I think people will be hospitalized.
The pants crapping is
there might be another.
Bad. Yeah, you thought the pants crapping was bad? Yeah, this is going to be like
pants shitting epidemic on the way.
Yeah, it is. There's a moment that Charles and I saw that briefly put us into a catatonic state. It was so insane. So yeah, it is. Yeah. It's going to be wild. Yeah.
Our guests today were Drew and Charles from the Light the Fuse podcast, the official Mission Impossible podcast. Be sure to subscribe and listen along every Tuesday. And you can also view their archives on their website, lightthefuse.com. You can use the links in our episode notes as well. Charles is the director and co-writer of Night Owls, now streaming on Tubi, Pluto, and Cinemax. And you can read Drew's work in many places, including The Wrap, The New York Times, Collider, etc. Many places. Go read it.
And don't forget, you can watch all the Mission Impossibles streaming on Paramount Plus. And in case you didn't catch it, Dead Reckoning Part 1 is exclusively in theaters right now. Thanks to our crew, our friendship circle, Sophie Shin for booking and looking after our guests, Sam for the art, and to Moniker for the theme music. Maybe consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can mention all the poop jokes we do.
Just give us 1 week with poop jokes. We've been waiting all year for this moment.
You can always drop us a line at podcast@letterbox.com. We love mail. The Letterbox Show is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.